from a story. Not only did it not matter when the harm occurred, EPA has no duty whatever to show that there was harm, and they have never shown, to my knowledge, that there was harm from any of these sites. All they need to show is that they could imagine harm, imagine some harm in the future. Okay, R.J. Smith is a senior environmental scholar at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a senior scholar at the Center for Private Conservation at CEI. He's a former president of a regional Audubon Society, and he was one of the earliest to see non-governmental solutions to environmental problems. I really thought I was one of the very first in back in the early 70s when Johnny Bob and I published our first article, I think it was 73, 74, the Journal of Economics. Turns out RJ had been writing for some time before that about private rights and conservation. He claims to have coined the term free market environmentalism for our approach. He may well be right. He's been in this for the long haul and contributed an enormous amount. He's going to talk about property rights as a tool of conservation and the guarantor of freedom.
I think the promise of free market environmentalism is the fact that it's the only hope we have of achieving what most of us want, which is both a free and prosperous society, I'm going to use the term, and a sound and healthy environment. And by using the institutions of a free society, by using property rights, by using free markets, by using the price system, by using economic incentives, I think we have hope there of finding ways to see that we can have a sound environment without losing our freedoms. Now, the thing I want to look at today is a little bit of how we've gotten into the broad attack that we've had on private property in this country coming from the environmental community, and why we've had so many problems with wildlife and wildlife habitat. And a lot of this simply comes because of the fact that most environmentalists really don't understand what happened in our history, nor for that matter to the public and the media. And one of the things that everybody's agreed upon is when the colonists first arrived, America had an unimaginable amount of wildlife. Many people, they viewed it as an Eden. There were bounties of fish, waterfowl, and game men, more than any people had ever dreamed of or had seen in Europe. It was particularly noted for the fish that went up the streams in New England. The salmon, in particular, in the Northeast. Some of the early people who arrived on boats complained about the fact that there would be so many salmon and some of the other fish trying to get up into the streams that they couldn't even get their boats up into the rivers. And it was very common for the indentured servants who came over, knowing that they were going to be forced to eat fresh salmon every single day as salmon season was on, to ask to have clauses put in their contracts of indentured son that they did not have to be served fresh salmon more than two or three times a week. Same thing went on with lobsters, eating all the bounty of lobsters in New England. Many of the people who lived off lobsters were sort of ashamed that they had to live off. When they finished their meal of lobsters, when they had lobster shells, when they had a little garbage pile outside the window or whatever, they would always put the lobster shells down at the bottom. So when their neighbors walked by, they wouldn't see that these people were forced to eat lobsters. As a matter of fact, I was speaking at a conference on the Endangered Species Act up in Maine yesterday, and there was an old farmer from New Brunswick who said that he could remember going to school as a child and how embarrassed he was because he had to take lobster sandwiches to school. And he goes and sit in the corner so all these kids who had bologna sandwiches and sandwiches wouldn't see how poor off he was. But of course, those days are long gone now with the shortages of salmon and the shortages of lobsters and so on. Another interesting point is that when the colonists arrived, there were about 100 million bison roaming the United States. And there were also zero cattle. And today there are about 100 million head of cattle and only a few thousand bison. There were also about 3 billion pasture pigeons. It was the most populous bird species that had probably ever existed on the earth. And the early naturalists talked about the pigeons migrating across the sky from horizon to horizon very strong incentives to overuse it. It's the rational thing to do. It's not that they have evil motives or something, but they must use it before somebody else comes along and does it. You're in a race to use the resource before somebody does. And this is what is known as the tragedy of the commons, Eric Hardin's famous piece on why so many resources are overused. But when people own resources, of course, it's just the opposite. The incentives operate differently. They have very strong incentives to use them carefully and to be good stewards. I mean, this is why you can see two kinds of behavior from a cattleman. A cattleman who grazes on his own privately owned land is very, very careful not to overgraze it, because if he does, he bears the full cost of his overgrazing, and eventually he's going to go bankrupt. But put the same cattleman onto public land, and he's not going to be quite as careful, because he doesn't bear all the costs. The public bears some of the costs. And of course, the shorter the term of his lease is, the less of a steward he's going to be. That's the same reason why the same guy will go out and overfish a stream, or he'll already have his limit of fish, and he sees the largest steelhead trout he's ever seen coming out of the stream, might look over his shoulder to see if there's a game warden around. Because he knows if he doesn't take that steelhead, it's not going to be there tomorrow. Somebody else is going to catch it. But if that guy owns a trout farm, he's not going to overfish his own trout, because he has very strong incentives not to. It's the same thing. You take that kind of analogy right down the line. It's why people will throw litter alongside the road, or when they go into a parking lot in a mall, they'll pull out their ashtray and tap it on the side of the car or something, but they won't do this in their own driveway or in their own backyard. And one of the reasons for this is that when American Wildlife was created, American Wildlife Law was created, the U.S. people decided that they were going to reject the European system, particularly the English system. They were going to reject private ownership of fish, birds, and mammals. For instance, in England, the landowner had owned the wildlife that was on his land. Now, this, of course, excluded a lot of the common people simply because of the English land tenure system from ever having a chance to hunt for a deer or whatever. And what they really didn't like in this country when they were creating wildlife law was the English land tenure system. But they sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater, because they said that they were not going to allow landowners to own wildlife. It was going to be the common heritage of all the American people that would be managed by the state. And the result of that decision was that American wildlife fell as if hit by a plague. Species after species disappeared because nobody owned them. You couldn't manage them on your land the way you would want to, so that you used them as pests. And so you did nothing to husband them or take care of them or make your land more attractive to them. Now, this is just the opposite of the system in many other countries, where they've had private ownership of wildlife or something very close to it, and that's worked extraordinarily well to protecting your wildlife. Many of you may know the United Kingdom, Norway, Iceland, and so on, have had very different approaches to the anadromous fish, the salmon and trout that are going up the streams. Instead of them belonging to everybody, like in the United States, people who lived along the sides of streams had the right to fish just in that section of the stream. And it could be a very, very valuable right. Some of the great salmon beaches in Scotland, you can pay up to $1,000 a day just to fish on that beach. And when a resource is that valuable to you, that makes the person who owns that property right a very good steward of that resource. And he has a very good incentive to watch for protection of all of the environmental quality and what is happening to the quality of the water. So if somebody upstream is polluting the water, whether it's a municipality with sewage, whether it's a corporation dumping pollution into the water, or even whether it's just a sheepman or cattleman who's grazing too close to the banks and you're silting up the gravel beds where the fish spawn. Since you have that property right, then you have very strong incentives to watch that happening. If it's happening, you go to court and seek an injunction and can get damages. And that has happened in the United Kingdom. It's happening in a lot of the world, and their fishing conditions for their salmon and so on are still magnificent. Well, you know, in our country, our salmon have disappeared both first on the East Coast and increasingly on the West Coast. Another example from Iceland has been allowing ownership or quasi-ownership of seabirds. For instance, the eider duck, the magnificent dam, that allowed the landowners to essentially own the ducks when they're nesting on their land. And so they attract the ducks to their land. They make little hollows in the ground where the birds will come and nest. They don't disturb them. And then when the female plucks the down from her nest to lie in the nest, they collect some of that, use that valuable down, and they protect the birds from feral foxes or from mink or something This has also worked well in a few places where we've been able to expand this into the sea. For instance, in most of the United States, you cannot own fee simple ownership of the intertidal zone, of the littoral zone. The one state in the United States that allows that is Washington State. And as you might realize, Washington State, therefore, has the healthiest oyster populations in the country because people can own the oyster beds and prevent anybody else from coming in and harvesting these oysters. And the other thing, again, once again, it brings out this ownership, self-interest, and being a good steward of the environment and protecting the environment. Because with oysters, you have to be extraordinarily careful of the quality of the water that crosses the land. And so the oystermen on the bays and estuaries along the coast of Washington have become some of the best protectors of water rights in their states. They're constantly out there watching to make sure that nobody is polluting. And it's argued that Malapa Bay on the south coast of the state of Washington has the finest water quality of any estuary in the United States. And to a large degree, that's attributable to the fact that people have property rights in that bay. And so the problem has not really been private property rights, and it's caused problems for the environment, for resources and wildlife in the United States, but the absence of property rights. Now, one of the other things the environmental community fails to understand is that America has a great history of private conservation, and this is largely unknown. And the whole history of this is very interesting. It sort of fits into Tocqueville's Democracy in America, his comments on America, the propensity of Americans to get involved in voluntary association. And he said something like the effect that whenever two or three Americans got together, they seemed to have belonged and joined and created four or five different associations. And these were all voluntary associations that no one was forced to join. And he noted that when American people saw problems, they went out and solved them themselves. And that's what happened to the people in America became aware of the fact that so much of our wildlife and wildlife habitat was disappearing. Beginning in about the late 1880s, hunters from across the United States, hunters and fishermen, and also a lot of the bluebloods in New England, began to take steps, private steps, to try and do something to turn the tide of the loss of the wildlife. Some of it was from a desire to maintain game populations or increase them. Some of it was from a sense of noblesse oblige. And one of the first efforts was a lot of hunters and bird watchers formed the National Audubon Society right at the turn of the century. And one of the main things they were interested in doing then was protecting the plume birds, the egrets that women were wearing in their hats in the millinery trade. And at that time, the egrets and herons and roseate spoonbills with all these beautiful long plumes were rapidly headed towards extinction. Their numbers in many cases were down to near zero. And there were no laws protecting these birds. Anybody could go out and do this. The Audubon Society started proselytizing and writing out bed pieces and handing out leaflets on the streets of New York City. But the thing they did was most important. They used the institution of private property. They went out, sent their biologists out to find the last islands on the coast of the Carolinas and Florida and the Gulf where these egrets were nesting, and they bought these and owned them in fee simple, set them aside as their sanctuaries, and then they hired their own wardens to protect them. And this sanctuary and warden system did more to begin to turn the tide on wildlife. And particularly, it's very interesting that the first wildlife warden in the United States to be killed in the line of duty was not a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service aide, but a private Audubon guy protecting a colony of egrets down in the Florida Everglades. And in fact, the second and third wardens to be murdered were private Audubon Society people. And this, as much as this then allowed editorials to come out all around the country shaming women. You have white plumes on your head and red blood on your hands. And this kind of graphic approach also helped, too. And the Audubon Society, besides working to save egrets, they began to buy all kinds of areas in which they were setting aside as private wildlife refuges. And one of the things they also early discovered was despite what they say locally now, they discovered that oil and wildlife can mix. And they found that they owned property which was a wildlife refuge, and it turned out that there was a possibility of an oil or gas field there. They could find ways to bring that online in an environmentally sensitive manner that didn't harm the wildlife. And of course, they didn't want to have any disasters happen, nor did the oil or gas companies that were drilling on their land. And in a number of cases in this country, they've been very, very successful. And of course, using the royalties to improve and better the someone can just own private property and use this to protect wildlife. Was the effort in this country, the first effort in the 1930s, to save the birds of prey, the hawks and eagles and falcons and owls. Up to that time, most biologists and most people have viewed them simply as vermin, had no real role in the ecosystem. They were bad birds, they ate the nice birds, the quail infested the hunter's life, and they ate the pretty birds that other people liked. And people who were trying to stop this really couldn't do much about it. Most states and many counties were paying bounties to encourage people to go out and slaughter all the raptors, all the birds, to bring it good. And there was a suffragette, a lady by the name of Rosalie Edge in the New York City, Philadelphia area, who single-handedly decided she was going to stop this, and she was trying to stop this, and this was during the 30s. And in fact, the Philadelphia newspapers wrote editorials suggesting that she was probably un-American to be doing this, because pretty soon red-blooded American boys might be fighting Germans again, and they needed a target practice on moving targets, so how dare her do that? Well, based on the fact that how could she ever get 51% of any legislature to vote to protect birds of prey when everybody knew they were evil and the government was paying bounties to stop them? She simply raised, very quietly, $3,500, and went and bought the entire mountain and set it up as her first bird of prey reserve in the world, and hired a warden to protect it, and pretty soon that changed the whole tide. Instead of people coming there to slaughter the birds of prey, people came there to pay to watch, and that helped turn the tide. And it's been that kind of approach of what people can do when they privately have a vision. And it doesn't take 51% of people, it just takes one person with a vision and some money, or go to raise the money, to go out and set some land aside and preserve it as a private sanctuary. And that's what we've been doing with the Center for Private Conservation. We've been going around the country and finding good examples of private stewardship, of what landowners are doing, whether they're big developers, like Hilton Head Island, which is the first to build within the environment instead of bulldozing and planting little trees. They were so green down there, the state had to step in and said, no, you can't paint stop signs and mailboxes and fire hydrants green. They have to be the right colors. I mean, they went all the way. And so we're documenting these stories, what developers are doing, ranchers are doing, farmers are doing, tree farmers are doing, timber companies, hunting and fishing organizations, land trusts, to get the story out to Americans that there's a whole story of private conservation and private stewardship. And what we need to be doing is encouraging, creating incentives for landowners to be good, to bring out the diversity of the marketplace. So we have tens of thousands of landowners who have a different idea of how we might save something, preserve something, rather than think we can do it all with one big cookie-cutter approach from the federal government. And anybody who would like to know more of these stories, we're printing them all the time at the Center for Private Conservation, will be happy to send them. Thank you.
Charge of Fred Smith and Fran are in charge of cooperative.